This is Ian Sykes, interviewed by Chris Alden Lee on the 28th of October 2011. Ian Sykes.
Ian Andrew Sykes, and I was born in Wetherby, Yorkshire. My father was a bookmaker in Leeds, and it was wartime, 1943. And as far as I know, he ran the black market in Leeds, or a big part of it. So there wasn't a great problem with petrol and things, but apparently it was deep snow, and Mum had me in Wetherby, and they couldn't get... My father never saw me for a fortnight because of the deep snow.
So in the winter of 47?
Winter of 47.
The famous winter.
No, 43.
43? 43,
yeah.
And what's your birthday?
10-1-43.
Okay. Well, and what kind of education did you have, Ian?
I went to a boarding school at the age of seven, Fulneck School, which is a Moravian boarding school between Leeds and Bradford at Pudsey. And I hated it. And I was there for 10 years.
You hated all 10 years?
All 10 years of it. I walked away with my back straight and without looking back, and I've never been near it since. It was a religious school, and they beat religion into you, and they actually beat it out of me.
Were your parents deeply religious?
No, not at all. But I think my father wanted me to be good at sports and things, and thought a boarding school education would have been good for me.
Did he ever venture into further education?
When I left school, I worked for the Geological Survey, and I did a sandwich course at Leeds University. I was working towards a degree in geology, but I used to pass the recruiting office on the way up to the university, and I walked in one day and signed on into the RAF, which was a good move. My parents went ballistic about it, but I've never regretted it.
As a pilot?
No, as an IRC. I went in, and I only went in for some leaflets, and the guy asked me what I did, and I said at the time I was I've always been a very enthusiastic mountaineer, and I was right into it. I was in my late teens, and my whole time was spent climbing going mostly in Langdale and the lakes. And they offered me mountain rescue, and I just signed on the spot. And it wasn't that I was done, because it took me about 6 months, having got into the services, to actually get myself onto mountain rescue. But I spent the next five years at RAF Kinloss in the north of Scotland, which is where I've lived ever since, really. And it was fantastic, because I got free mountaineering and climbing at the expense of the services, and learnt everything I know, really, from them.
At what point did the Antarctic make an appearance in your life? Had you read about the heroes as a boy? Or?
Well, when I was demobbed from the RAF, I originally worked in Reading for the Reading Evening Post for a short time, and then wondered what on earth I was doing there, and decided I'd go back up to Scotland and see what I could manage. And I went up to Fort William, and I got a job as a climbing instructor at a new outdoor centre, the Lochiel Centre, which at that time was Toc H. So that was a religious bunch as well, but has subsequently become an Outward Bound school. And Lochiel was, again, they were wanting climbers to work for them. And I became very friendly with John Cunningham, who was a... at that time he'd been down once. I think it went down again, and he was very helpful, and said that I would, told me I would love it, and started describing life on the bases. And he was one of my, one of the people that recommended me when I applied for Bass. And I really didn't think I would get the job. I was pretty young, and surprisingly. Though my age was, the same age as most of us that joined, actually I'd been already done 5 years in the RAF and various things. So I was actually slightly more experienced than quite a lot. So I actually got through the interview not too bad. It was Bill Sloman that, plus I can't remember who the other... I got it, you know, which absolutely staggered me. And also discovered that I got paid. It was, I think it was 500 a year that we got paid at that time. But I thought that you went down for nothing, and which I was quite happy about. And that was it, really. I got.
Had you read about Scott and Shackleton and Amundsen?
A little bit. I wasn't a great expert on the subject, but yes, to a certain extent. I mean, any mountaineer had a great affinity with Shackleton, you know, what went on. I didn't know anything like, you know, once you become a FID, how interested you become in the whole thing. But yes, I had. That wasn't what was driving me. It was the thought of getting out and dog sledging and climbing mountains and that kind of thing was what attracted me to it.
And when you got there, was it what you hoped for?
Oh, yeah, and more. It was terrific. I was very lucky. I seemed to hit gold on all fronts, really. I went down on the Shackleton with Frosty as captain.
Turnbull.
Captain Turnbull, yeah. And at first, I thought he was the most terse person I'd ever met, but actually began to really admire him. He was a wonderful, wonderful captain. Myself, two friends I had was Phil Wainwright and Ian Flavel-Smith. And Phil and I signed on as crew on the ship, working not just as supernumeraries, but we realised that we're going to be for several months on board ship, and I thought I would die of boredom if I didn't do something. So I signed as crew. Frosty wasn't keen. He sort of said, "Yeah, you fids don't do any work anyway." But anyway, we swore blind that we would. So we had to do shifts the same as the rest of the crew and go on the same project. And it was the best thing I ever did because though it was hard work, it was really interesting. And I got to know how FIDs worked much better than I'd been if I'd been stuck in the fiddery with the rest of them. So it was really good. And then that particular year they were building at Halley Bay. So Frosty again helped us. We got on. We got a trip down to Halley Bay on the, what was it?
Pearl of Dan?
Pearl of, no, it was the... the Pearl of Dan, yes, down the Pearl of Dan, and we're helping do the base there. And I worked on in the Falkland Islands at surveying the airstrip and various other things. And it was quite a long trip down, and we were involved with the eruption on Deception Island, which was the most exciting of things that happened, you know.
Come to that in a minute. Tell me about what you were doing at Halley Bay.
They were building a new base. The old base
was 68, was it?
This must have been 68. I think it was 68, 67. Yes, 68. And we were just building the base. The old place was totally, it had bent up inside and was leaking so that all the heat had gone out of it. And they were living in a fairly rough and ready state down in it. And the new base was being put up there. And we were down for a few weeks just helping hauling stuff up, you know, as FIDs do. We were there as man-made cranes.
So why did you come out of Halley? You obviously weren't destined to be there for the whole season.
No, it was just that the Pearl of Dam was going down, and they sent a bunch of us FIDs down to do the work.
Right.
And then we came back out. So, you know, it's very rare for Peninsula FIDs to actually get down to Halley.
Exactly. Yeah.
So it was very nice to achieve that. And then went back to South Georgia, and we were there for quite a while, and then started working our way down the peninsula. And it was lucky because it was one of those years where the ship was going into all the old bases, so we got a it was very exciting. Got into all the Hope Bay and loads and loads of places. I can't remember them all now. And finally got to Stonington in the autumn.
So how did you get wrapped up in the caught up in the Deception Island scenario?
Well, we'd been on Deception Island. They were building a new aircraft hangar there, and we were building, you know, helping put up the hangar, and it was real hard work because they were using a rubber flubber to take all the steel girders and things out to the shore. And mostly we spent our time in the water in waders on, and the stuff would come in because the flubber couldn't pull it right onto the shore. So we got, you know, FID power to lift the girders out to the. So I spent days and days sort of wading around in freezing cold water trying to get these girders ashore, with Big Al Smith at one end and about six of us at the other end, and trying to get them ashore. It was a very interesting time. And then when finally headed south, we had headed back towards South Georgia, and we'd been going for about a day, I think, when there was a sudden spin round of the boat and it turned back and was hammering on at full pelt. And they told us that Deception Island was erupting. And actually, most of us took it as a joke because we had the piss taken by Frosty most of the time, so we didn't believe everything we were told. But it really was the most exciting thing when we finally got there. Frosty went straight in through Neptune's bellows into the bay, with the eruption still going on at a great rate of knots. When we first went in, we were unable to get ashore because of the danger. The sea level was going up and down at a great rate, and we went outside the island for it, so we were able to cruise around and watch the whole thing going off, and then went back in to try and rescue some of the equipment from the base, which we were doing when it had started to erupt again, and with a quick escape. In the meantime, the guys that were had been rescued by the, I think it was the Yelcho, the Argentinian boat. They managed to get them back to us, and everybody was okay. But it was very, very exciting, and I got loads of photographs, typical FID, you know.
Were you being showered upon by?
Showered by ash all the time, and nothing great. So one of the things that I do remember and laugh about was that the sheath bills, there were hundreds of sheath bills came aboard the ship. They don't seem to like flying, and the ship was absolutely covered in sheath bills that were sitting there being taken off the island quite happily under manned steam sort of thing. Apparently they're quite good flyers as well, but this lot just sat on the ship and got taken away.
Could they not? I guess they couldn't fly through the ash, could they?
I don't know. But it was. I've got photographs of it, of the ship covered in the things. You know, it was very, very strange. And it was funny going back again. I've been back a couple of times since, and seeing the wreck of the island as it was when I first went there. It was the most beautiful place, you know. And the inner bay was all frozen and solid, and I was climbing on some of the gullies at the back, and it was just lovely. And you go now and see this sort of devastation that's taken place. It's quite amazing.
What sort of things were you rescuing from the base?
I think it was more or less a lot of personal equipment as much as anything, and anything that would, you know, there was loads of equipment on the base, and we just tried to ferry it down to the ship's boat, the Red Peril, which we were just loading up with as much stuff as we could and getting it ashore. But it was a real mess, and of course the roof of the base was collapsing in with the weight of ash that was falling. And at the time we were loading it on, it seemed that it had quietened down, and then all of a sudden the whole thing went off again, and we got the hell out of it, and that was that, really.
Do you remember anything about the base safe being rescued or reached?
No, I can't remember that.
Okay.
No.
And then you just simply left it to its own devices, I guess.
The problem was that we were still heading south. You know, our plot to my, I think that held us up on the journey south. So there was quite a race then to get us down to Stonington, and I can't actually remember. The funny thing is, I think I must have swapped boats there onto the Biscoe, but I'm not too clear on it, because all the photographs I've got are of us going into Stonington on the Biscoe, which is rather odd because my memory is as if I was still on the Shackleton, but hey.
When you got to Stonington, you took over a dog team, didn't you?
Yeah, the Vikings, yeah.
Were you familiar with dogs?
No, never at all. It was John Noble who had them the year before me, and he had set them up. They were beautiful. I mean, the dogs he'd got, and he'd sort of matched them up into matching pairs. I got this very beautiful team. I never thought they were that good. I did a lot of changing of the team in the early days, and I was actually only at Stonington for less than a week when we were taken by ship to Blakelock Island. There was a group of us. Derek Postlethwaite was the experienced FID that had been there a year earlier, and with a bunch of us got landed on the Jones Ice Shelf at Blakelock Island, and the idea was that we were a couple of months or a month or so learning to drive the dogs and to get the experience, and then head back for Stonington in time for midwinter. But it was appalling condition. It was a really, but the problem was that we didn't know whether it was bad or not. It seemed pretty normal to us because we didn't know anything else. But that particular trip, we had a 16-day lie-up and two 11-day lie-ups, and we were unable to get back for midwinter. So we were out for, you know, best part of 3 months in what everybody said was appalling conditions. Well, we were actually okay, but I think they were in London office, they were very worried about us. And I did hear on the grapevine afterwards that that particular trip was one of the things that got Bass thinking that the days of dogs might well be over because of the difficulty that we had in getting back. So it was well after midwinter that we finally the sea ice finally formed. In fact, we'd won attempt to get back to Horseshoe Island, and my sledge broke through the sea ice and was floating around. We did a hell of a job. You know, we managed to hitch two dog teams onto it and haul it out, and it was quite frightening. You know, it was basically snow lying on the water that we got. So we turned round and headed back. So we spent midwinter at Blakelock Field Hut, actually living in tents, but using the hut as a little sort of place to dust. We'd loads of food and plenty of dog food, so it was no great difficulty. And finally, when the sea ice formed up, off we went back to Horseshoe Island and then back along to Stonington.
How big was the hut?
The hut, ooh, it was about the size of a garden shed, you know.
So you couldn't sleep in there, really?
Well, you could have done, probably. There were actually bunks in it, but there were six of us sledging, two groups of three, and it would have been too tight for that, and it wasn't very well insulated. It was... you could, you know, as long as you got some heat into it, it was okay. And we, as you could say, we'd got plenty of food and fuel, but it was warmer living in the tents outside. Our big worry was dog food. I mean, we spent a lot of the time hunting for seals.
These lie-ups, how do you feel about being stuck? Were you stuck in the field for 16 days at a time in tents?
Well, on that particular trip, we'd won 16-day lie-up where we didn't move at all.
How was that? How do you feel about that?
Oh, it was nice. It was interesting. You slowly got kind of mixed up. Remember that at this time of the year, we'd lost the sun. So although it got light during the day, it didn't, you know, it was a bit like Scotland with the sun not quite coming up. So it, and we had a tendency to, we didn't not move. Most days, there was so much snow falling at the time, we had to move the tents and dig the dogs out, but you couldn't travel in it, so we were stuck. But your day started to reverse. There's no point in getting out of bed. You know, you'd wake in the morning and stick your head out, and it would be snowing heavens high and blowing, and the tent was partially buried. You know, so you would climb back into your sleeping bag and sleep for a couple of hours. So assuming that you got up normally at 8 o'clock in the morning, you know, that day you might get up at 11 o'clock and we would go and do a few chores. And then by the end of a week or so, you know, your 11 o'clock had turned to 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and the whole thing began to get kind of mixed up. But we had the daily skeds, you know, the radio skeds with Stonington telling them what we were doing and not, which wasn't a lot. And you still had to go out and feed the dogs and do all the other things that were required. And the difficulty was, of course, you got lazy, you know, as you think, because we were... also we got very a little bit irritated that we couldn't move. But that particular trip, and I never had the likes of it again, but we had 16 days and then 2 11-day layups, all in the same thing, with deep, deep snow, with on some occasions the tent, which is 8 feet odd high, was totally buried, as of course the dogs and everything were. So it was a daily job to get up and start digging and dig the whole blooming thing out and then restart. So it was very interesting. But I thought that was normal. That was my very first sledging trip. And I guessed, you know, that I thought that was what you did. So it was only kind of afterwards that we discovered that it was a bit unique, that we'd had a fairly bad weather trip.
Stonington and Fossil Bluff had a close relationship. But that particular winter, there was problems with Fossil Bluff, weren't there? There were more people there than there should be.
Yes, the Pilatus Porter aircraft crashed up on the polar plateau. Nobody hurt. It crashed on takeoff, and the boys managed to sledge into Fossil Bluff. So there were four of them there, and I think two of them were supposed to be going home that year. But of course, by the time that this happened, there was no other aircraft to come in and get them out, and they were stuck. So there were all kinds of problems for them. But two of them had to do an extra year, and names have gone out of my head at the moment.
Doesn't matter.
But one of them was going to be base commander at Adelaide, I think, and didn't make it. And of course, we were quite anxious about them at Stonington, because they were living in tents outside the hut. The generator wasn't working. In fact, there's an interesting story about the generator. I remember listening to Barry Whitaker, and he was a diesel mechanic at Adelaide, helping. What was his name? The guy that was at Fossil Bluff. I've forgotten his name.
The base leader.
Base leader there.
I have to look it up.
It doesn't matter anyway. He was working the generator and trying to get it going, and Barry was saying, try this, try that, try the other, and then very excitedly he said, is this sprocket pin coming out? He said, yes, yes it is. He said, oh, I'll turn the handle and see if it goes, and he said, yes, yes, it's doing it. And he said, well, in that case it's fucked. So they were stuck without a generation or a power for the whole of that winter. So, in fact, as FIDs do, they settled in and got on with it. But we were quite anxious about it. So at Stonington, we decided that they'd go down as early as they possibly could as a relief party to the Bluff.
It was either Leddingham or...
Oh, it was Rod Leddingham.
Yeah, in 68.
Yeah.
And you were in that relief party, were you?
No, I wasn't. It was Ian Flavel-Smith and Alistair... Ali MacArthur, the base commander of Stonington, and various others went off. And they were being gone about 5 days when they came up on the radio rather anxiously and said that they were on flows trying to get onto George VI Sound, and they were pretty sure that they were on the move and floating about. Now, in those days, I mean, nobody had ever been drifting off on open sea ice and never survived it, so there's a great deal of panic on base as to what to do. They were still sounding fairly confident down the time. But myself, Derek Postlethwaite and Ken Doyle put an inflatable dinghy on our sledges and set off as fast as we could down to try and get to them before things got bad. And the weather was really quite bad. It was snowing and... thing, and we did a long journey, but it was amazing that we realised that we could travel in really appalling conditions, which we normally wouldn't have done on the bases at that time, and went down right past Terra Firma Island and down through, and it was really quite nerve-wracking because it was very stormy, and camping on the sea ice, you could hear it creaking and squeaking underneath you. It was really nerve-wracking run. Anyway, we approached within reasonable range of them, the weather actually started to improve and it actually got colder. The temperature dropped down. It was about in the minus 30s, and the sea ice started to really form up quite good. So we actually got to the Puffball Islets just about the same, having crossed a number of leads without having to use the boat. And we got there just about the same time. So we're all on terra firma and relatively safe. The decision was taken that it was too early to try and get right down to the Bluff. So we turned round and headed back to Stonington, which we got back a few days later.
So the purpose of your rescue mission was to get more supplies to them, food and power?
Well, it was really to... ours was to get the boys off the open sea ice. Mm. As it turned out, it didn't. It wasn't, you know, things were improving rather than getting better.
Did you have a plan? Because if they were drifting on ice flows, did you have a plan? The plan was to use a boat to get to
them. The plan was to use the boat to get to them. Yeah, we were assuming that it was it wasn't tiny wee flows floating about. We're talking about big areas of sea ice with big flows. Because what had happened, they'd sledged across open flows, you know, with big cracks in the sea ice, but the cracks were widening up behind them. So when they tried to get back, they couldn't get across. They were on open water. And then they'd gone forward and then found they got to open water ahead as well. So there was at the time that they started to get sort of worried, they were afloat without being able to get... But we weren't thinking in terms of open sea crossings or anything like that, but the idea was that we could ferry the sledges and the dogs and things across with the wee boat to get onto the next large
leads,
area.
Yeah.
Leads. And
do you think, in retrospect, do you think you were more worried at Stonington than they were on the ice?
I think so, yes, probably. And it was almost the same as what happened with ourselves on the Heim Glacier project that I was telling you before. Was that when you're there, it was not quite as bad as everybody's imagining it, that it might be. And we were very cautious, you know. I mean, we weren't... I don't think anybody was being fools to...
Fuchs became involved, didn't he, in this particular escapade?
Well, yes. Yes, he was great. I mean, really admired him, you know, because he understood that the problem was ours and was giving us the confidence to do what we thought was the best thing and really kind of telling us to be sensible, but not trying to give us orders. He was terrific. Great boss, actually.
You admired him?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Did you meet him?
Lots of times, yes. Well, not lots of times, but on my interview when I first went, and then on the year I went down, and laterally with quite a good story on the year on the way back, which I'll tell you. Well, I built a canoe at Stonington. You might have heard about this, but it was I'd been a canoeing instructor on Outward Bound before I went down, and I used it for sealing quite a lot at Stonington. It was very good. But when I decided to take it home on the way back, and it was on board ship. We stopped in at the Argentine Islands where Bunny Fuchs met up with us, and it was glorious weather in summertime or autumn, and the sea ice was broken out, and we got the canoe out, and was canoeing around the floes and things there. And the base commander was very upset about it and thought it was very dangerous and that we shouldn't be doing it. And it kind of banned me from taking the canoe out, which was a bit annoying, having been doing a lot more canoeing further south without any problem. Anyway, luckily, Bunny came along and said, "Ooh, I like that canoe. Let's have a go." So off he went, and I thought, well, that's it. I've got my permissions granted. So he had quite a few trips in it. And I took the decision that it was actually a better home for it was Argentine Islands rather than taking it back. So I left it there. And in fact, I've learned relatively recently that they did quite a lot of canoeing from there. And actually got three other canoes sent down on previous years and used them during those years.
Was there a risk attached to that canoeing in your kayak?
Well, there was. In fact, I capsized on the very first day I built it. I put it in the water and I'd made paddles out of an aluminium tent pole and some plywood. And I was paddling along and quite heavily pushing, and the blade of one of the paddles, which was fairly weak plywood, just snapped, and it was so sudden I just capsized and went straight in, and it's quite chilly in the Antarctic in the water, and I managed to get out onto a floe, and but my canoe was floating away. I'd spent weeks building this this thing, so I jumped in again and managed to yank it out and get it up onto the floe. And by this time, it was really cold, but I got out and then managed to run back across the floes to Stonington. And Ali MacArthur, the base commander, was a little bit taken askance, when this dripping, frozen character charged into the thing. But I had a quick shower and whatnot, and then went and retrieved my canoe and just totally ignored them when they said it was too dangerous and rebuilt and made a proper paddle and got on with the job.
There was once a sledging trip where you went over the Leboeuf Fjord to meet a party from Adelaide. Is that right?
Oh, yeah.
What was that?
That was very... Well, that year, which must have been the beginning of my second year, Ian Kerfey and Rod Pashley, the two dog drivers at Adelaide, mm-hmm. had no changeover. There was no FIDs there, no sledging drivers to
take over the dogs.
To teach them how to run dogs. So they taught themselves how to get on with it. But we were working up in the islands up to the north, and they were coming out. They were going to join us for the summer journeys. So we decided to sledge over and meet them as they came off Adelaide. And it was really deep, heavy snow. They had a terrible journey across. Meanwhile, we went across over again onto the Jones Ice Shelf at Blakelock, and then across the Leboeuf Channel to past Pinero Island and met them at what is now Rotherhithe Base. At that time, there was nothing there. But we did know that there had been plans to build a base there. But all it was just a snowy beach. So the boys came down and we sledged back across. And by the time we were about halfway across, the sun, it was fairly early in the season. The sun had gone down, so we were travelling by moonlight. And we had a lot of difficulty getting onto the Jones ice shelf. There were a lot of crevasses there. Not particularly dangerous, but a lot of holes and slow progress. And we got onto the Jones ice shelf in lovely moonlight. And there was another party of sledges over at about 6 miles, 7 miles across the Jones. And they kept coming onto the radio and saying, "You must come over, you must come over. It's really important." So we had this lovely moonlight night sledge across the Jones ice shelf, dead flat, and with the silver light, it was just gorgeous. And we got about a mile or so from the camp, and the dogs got a sniff of the other dogs at the other side, and then we did this lovely run into the base where they met us out. And normally you would see to your dogs instantly and do it, but on this occasion we leapt into the tent. Within a minute or so of being in the tent, we listened on the radio to Neil Armstrong land on the moon. You know, one small thing for a man. It was the most glorious situation. You know, there we were in a part of the world where there wasn't a map. There was no map there. There was a far better map of the moon than we had. And this great big full moon shining, and it was just awesome, you know. I'll never forget it. It was just an incredible thing.
Did you feel any kind of affinity with the astronauts?
Oh, we did. Yeah, absolutely.
Can you describe it?
Well, I think we actually sent telexes. You know, we had a message to say that we were Sledge Whiskey. You know, my sledge was Sledge Whiskey, we sent a message to Houston, you know, to say Sledge Whiskey in Antarctica, listen to you. We never ever got a reply, but we felt very much part of it. And of course, the rest of the world had been watching it on television in a sort of broken up sort of way, but certainly knew what the things like the LEM looked like. But we had no idea because we'd only listened to it on the radio. It was a glorious moment. I always remember it, and I always thought that we would be going there. I thought I'll somehow find a way of getting to the stars before I'm done. But it's surprising that they've never gone back. You know,
One of the other figures was saying that you shared the same vulnerability as the astronauts. If anything had gone wrong, there was no way you could have been helped.
I think that's right. I think particularly as a GA, you know, the GA's, you know, it's a fairly lowly job. We're working with scientists, but we felt the great responsibility to see that everybody was all right. And particularly having come out of mountain rescue, you know, my original jobs, you know, I was always very conscious that we were in a very dangerous environment. That didn't seem dangerous.
Until something goes wrong.
Until something went wrong, it wasn't. And you know, Fids are very jocular and take things as they come. But I found it quite a serious responsibility, looking after people and seeing that they were all right. And I used to be quite surprised at how naive some of the scientists could be. As to, you know, you really had to keep eyes in the back of your head that people would, you know, walk around in crevasses without any concern whatsoever, you know. But in my 2.5 years, really, at Stonington, we had no accidents at all, and I was very proud of that. I thought it was a good effort.
So were Armstrong and Aldrin GAs?
I think they must have been. I think they would have been made very good GAs. Possibly, what was his name, the guy that was going...
Collins.
Collins might have been the GA looking after the mount on the top, you know. Now you mention it, yeah, there's definitely an affinity with it. But, it seems such a long time ago, but it was a wonderful experience. You know?
You were supporting a geologist called Ali
Skinner. Yeah.
Were you into geology?
Well, I'd actually done quite a lot of geology at university before I packed it in, so I wasn't totally
naive
to it. Ali was probably the youngest FID of all time, actually. He got his degree at a very young age, and we sledged that year. Normally you have two dog teams and two guys working together, but in fact Ali didn't have a dog team, so we were out with just the one team, with the Vikings, and we did a tremendous journey. We went down to Fossil Bluff and then up the Otter Glacier onto the plateau, where we camped at the site of the Pilatus Porter that was crashed at what was called Porter Depot, which was basically all the stuff that was left dropped inside the Porter. And Ali was one of those people that couldn't light a Primus stove properly. He always had yellow flames bouncing around it, and on one particular occasion, I remember we were supposed to work together all the time, but in fact, it wasn't practical. What we used to do is I'd drop him off at a Nunatak to do the geology of it. I was doing the plane table mapping for him, to him making the map, and he was putting the map onto the geology onto the map. So I would dump him off on doing his geology, and I would go off mapping. And on this particular occasion, I'd done a series of cairns up this long glassy. We'd gone around in a big circle, and I was trying to close my circle. And I'd vanished off for a few hours. And as I came back down the glacier, I saw smoke rising from the campsite, and I thought, I wonder what he's burning a day. But as I came over the rise, I realised that what he was burning was the tent. The tent was fully ablaze and going, yeah. So, big panic. And when I got there, Ali was jumping around, looking rather askance. It wasn't a life-threatening situation. We had a little pup tent, which we could have used. And I felt quite confident that we could sledge to the bluff with what we had. My sleeping bag had been burnt. Ali's was okay. He managed to throw his own out and not mine. And what had happened was he'd making himself a brew, and he'd got a pot of glue out that he was gluing his mucklucks up with, and the glue had caught fire, and the whole thing went up in a flash. So, and normally in those days we had these squad call radios, and the radio hung in the apex of the tent up in the point, and of course that had got melted and things, so it didn't appear to have radio contact or anything. So I decided, well, I think we'd better head for the bluff and sort ourselves and see what to do. Somebody will get a hold of somebody there. Anyway, just as we were all packed up and ready to get ourselves going, I was messing around with the plastic, what was left of the radio, and it crackled a bit. And I actually suddenly came alive, and it was there was an aircraft about to take off from Adelaide, flying to the bluff, and I said, "Oh, mayday, mayday," you know. And of course they thought it was a joke, and it took a little bit of convincing of what had happened. But the lucky thing was that within 2 hours we'd a brand new tent, new sleeping bag, and
they parachuted them down.
They just flew them to us, you know.
Yeah.
The pilot was a chap called I think it was Dave Rowley.
Oh, he's here.
Is he here? Yeah. Well, I always laughed. I'd never met him, and it was his first flight ever. And he came flying. Of course, we were very relieved to see him coming in. And he he was sort of full of the Antarctic myth, you know, saw this, you know, burnt out tent and two guys standing there. And he flew down, landed, taxied up to the tent, and then spun the plane round to, I think his idea was to take a nice photograph of it with the, but of course the backdraft from the thing, we'd been sorting all our stuff into piles and the whole lot got blown off down the glacier, you know. So he jumped out smiling out of the plane to find these two bearded characters leaping upon him and screaming abuse and whatnot. They all said it was a very strange meeting that he had with us. But anyway, we got everything back and going, and that was it. But that was an interesting little experience.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
To Al, we created a fantastic trip that we went right down. Over the other side onto the is it the last ice shelf on the other side, down the Weyerhaeuser Glacier with a lot of big holes getting down there, met up with other sledging parties, and then came back over the polar plateau and down Snowdonbred slope to Stonington. And I'd never been up Snowdonbred, thank God, because when we went in on a compass bearing to find the top of it, and when I looked over, I was absolutely shocked. I was expecting a fairly steep snow slope down. I wasn't expecting basically a gully, and we decided to camp at the top for the night and then go down the following day, and We took the dogs for a bit of a run beforehand before we went over. We didn't want them pulling too hard when we went over the edge. And then when we kept looking at it, in the end, I went over on both teams. By that time, we'd be joined by Jack Donaldson. And so there's Jack and Ali on one sledge and myself on my own with the Vikings on the other. And we've just had three dogs pulling the sledge over and turned the others loose down. And we'd every rope and dog chain and everything all wrapped around the runners to slow it down. And, I mean, within seconds, once we went over the edge, we were sledging past the poor old dogs that were just pulled onto their backs. And we just literally, it was about a 4,000-foot slide down this incredible slope. And at the bottom was jumping crevasses, you know, not big ones, you know. I remember just landing in a big heap at the bottom and rolling about in laughter, you know, and then watching the other sledge coming down as well. It was astonishing. And then a lovely run into Stonington.
Tell me about your unusual materials for washing the base windows.
Oh, well, Stonington was unique in a lot of ways. Bass supplied all the bases with a bottle of whiskey, a bottle of brandy, I think, and a bottle of gin once a month. Now, that normally wouldn't go very far, but at Stonington, because we were a sledging base, I mean, in my second year, I was only 3 weeks on the base in the whole time that I was there. First year, I was about 3 months, but I wasn't unique. Everybody was much the same. We were there one day, and so there was a big build-up of booze on the base. There was loads of it, and not a lot of people drank gin. So there were buckets of the stuff, and if you wanted to clean the windows, you just went and got a bottle of gin out and cleaned the windows with gin, you know. No problem at all.
Was it effective?
Oh, yeah, just clean it off.
I suppose trying to clean the windows with water would have been fairly futile.
Well, they couldn't do it. It wouldn't work. But, you know, I suppose you could use diesel or petrol or something like that, but we'd far more gin to spare than that. There wasn't a lot of the other stuff. That got polished away. But,
And I gather practical jokes weren't unheard of. There was one that poor old Dr. Mike Holmes suffered.
Oh, yes, the we were the bar in Stonington was a beautiful place. I don't know what something terrible happened to it, I think, but it was when it was taken out. But it was a very comfortable, homely place, and we were sitting at the bar one night, Holmes always pontificated in great detail. He was a great raconteur, and he was chatting away. And he went out to the toilet, and I poured his pint of beer out, and there was a big jar of pickled onions at the side, and I topped it up with the juice from the pickled onions. And he came back in, and it was incredible. All of us were watching, and he kept raising the glass to his mouth and then starting to talk. And he'd sort of raise the glass, and then he'd put it down, and he'd start telling some other story, and then he'd raise it again, and we'd all wait expectantly to see what happened. And when he finally took a glug of this stuff, you know, he must have got half the pint of it down before his eyes started to roll, and it was the most incredible thing. And then, woof, you know, the whole lot came out. Very funny.
What was he like as a man, as a doctor?
Oh, well, he's a very good doctor. You know, we always used to call him the drunken doctor. He drank quite a lot, and he was a very interesting character. But as far as his medical thing, there was none like him. And of course, there was the terrible thing that was going on with Ken Portwine on Argentine Islands, and Ken was very, very ill. And Mike did manage to diagnose what the problem was and was able to do quite a lot to help him. We weren't supposed... I was sledging out in the field at the time, and they used to come on with these skeds and say, this is a medical sked, will everybody turn off their radios, you know? And you could hear all the tuning signals of all the sledges going on, you know, as it going on. But everybody was very, very worried and upset about what happened. And of course, it was very sad of what happened to Ken.
So you witnessed, I know it was remotely, it was by radio rather than there in person, but you witnessed how Mike handled that scenario.
Oh, yes, I thought he did a fantastic job. Yeah, really good. Yeah.
Was there any time when he felt, when he wasn't coping? Was he under pressure?
No, I don't think so. I mean, he was, like all of us, he was pretty boozy, was Mike, you know. Mm. But, I think you know, when the chips were down, he was a good doctor. In fact, I had a lot of sinus troubles, and Mike did quite a lot to sort me out. I thought he was a very clever bloke. You know, he was sledge with him on occasion. He was full of the myth of sledging, but he was hard work to go with. He wasn't an easy man to look after in the field. He was keen as mustard.
Good. A couple of scary incidents. One about sledging on thin ice in George the Sixth Sound.
Oh, well, yes, that was our attempt. So we
that got, was when you were heading the rescue attempt.
That was on the rescue attempt. That was we were on quite thin ice a lot of that trip. And I have to say, I didn't sleep much at night.
Because of the noise?
Well, there was just one had the feeling that the ice wasn't safe. It was it was well documented that where the ice broke out mostly. But we had to cross between the mainland and Terra Firma Island, which is a relatively safe place. But there's a thing called Windy Valley that comes out from the side of there. And there's always these big katabatic winds that come out of Windy Valley. And it was going across there that we really started going, crossing quite a number of open leads. Not big, you know, about 3 feet maybe. But the dogs don't like jumping. The dogs were getting wet on getting across those. And of course, you wonder what you're getting onto. And then the ice was very slushy and you could probe through it. And it got very, very scary. Fortunately, the weather improved for us. That was one occasion. The other one, I mentioned it before, on getting back from Blakelock Island to Horseshoe, my sledge broke through. I think it was a seal's blowhole because a seal kept coming up while my sledge was floating about. And I was sort of, I'd got one of these big, long, you know, ice chisels that I was trying to break it away from, and also trying to get the dogs together to haul the sledge out. And it wouldn't. Fortunately, the sledge was floating. It was, you know, the gear was on it. But the we managed to hitch two dog teams together, and they managed to yank it out. And that was unpleasant because a lot of my clothing and sleeping bags got quite wet with salt water. And though I managed to get them dry out, they were salt contaminated, and it was quite an unpleasant the rest of the trip. With sort of sweaty nights with this salt-contaminated sleeping bags and things.
I have to ask you about Ian Flavel-Smith chasing his gravimeter or gravimeter through the crew crevasses.
Oh, yeah. That was... We went on a geophysics trip up the back of Stonington. It was actually... We went to try and climb Mount... to what was called Mount Wilcox. I think it might be called Mount Metcalf now. They changed the name. It was a great, it was a lovely trip, and very exciting that the mountain was in a very difficult place to get to. We had to sledge up a very steep col with a lot of crevasses about, and then down into this sort of beautiful cirque where the mountain was in a very isolated place. And we got onto this col and we were sorting things out, and Flavel was taking some gravity readings, and all of a sudden his gravity meter fell over and rolled off down the slope. And of all things, he just ran after it. And there were holes all over the place, and I absolutely panicked. You know, I just... you know, grabbed a rope and screaming after him, trying to yell at him to stop. Luckily, the gravitometer stopped, but he must have gone over a number of holes and things. And I was extraordinarily worried, but, you know, absolutely nothing happened, thank God. But it was just one of those. And I think a gravitometer in those days, you know, talking about something in the late 60s, it cost about 5,000 quid then. So that must have been £50,000 worth of gravity meter that was bouncing down the hillside. I can see why he ran after it, but very, very, and luckily it was okay. It was still working.
Are you a bit of a songsmith on the quiet?
Yes, I sing. Yeah, play the banjo badly.
What's this about a song called Bass Knows Best?
That all
was that you?
Yeah, that was myself and Jack Donaldson wrote it between us. We wrote two or three songs. There was one called The Hangar Builder, which is about building the hangar on Deception Island before it blew up. And the other one was Bass Knows Best, which again was about deception, which was the thing. It was my first ever published song. It was published anonymously in Fuchs's book, but I was always very proud of it. Yeah, yes. So I sing that at an occasional drunken evenings.
This is the one about, I guess this is about Hallie, the bass with the bandy legs.
No, that's not me.
That's not you?
No, okay, no, you definitely not. No.
Okay. All right. Your 2 years were up. Did you think about reapplying, or were you happy to finish?
No, I'd actually reapplied. I did think I was going to come back down, and I managed to get a job in the Mount Hood National Park in North America. And so I thought I would go and work there for the summer and then go down the following year. And everything seemed to be going according to plan. But we hitchhiked up through South America, and I really wasn't very well throughout the whole time. We got arrested in Uruguay, suspected guerrillas, and we had quite a bit of difficulty getting out of there. And when I finally got back to Montevideo, luckily the ship, one of the Bass ships came in, and we got a lift home. And I was quite ill for a while. I never managed to take up the job in the Mount Hood National Park. And I got offered my old job as... Well, I got the chief instructor's job offered at the Outward Bound School in Fort William. And when I went back up, this little shop came up for thing, and without any intention of it becoming anything at all, it seemed like a good idea. So I never ever took up the job. I started this little shop, and it grew into quite a large business.
This is Nevis Sport.
Nevis Sport, yeah.
Yeah.
So that was it.
You've picked up some awards, haven't you, Spike? Is that an MBE? Not for the Antarctic, but for sport and mountain rescue.
Yes, I was on the mountain rescue team. If you include my time on FIDS, I joined mountain rescue in 1960, and I didn't. I stepped down from the main team in 1999, so I was 40 years in mountain rescue. So I was involved in one or two fairly interesting rescues, you know, over the years, and I surprisingly got involved in the setting up of Nevis Range, the ski area, and at the end of that I got an MBE, which was really from a lot of other people's efforts rather than mine, but there you go. And
how does the Antarctic rate in your life?
Oh, it's the best time of the lot. I would love to go back again. You know,
I'd go back tomorrow.
Oh, I'd go back tomorrow. I went back down in 2002. You know, on one of the FIDS trips, and I suppose it was sad, really. You know, the dogs were gone, and it was a different world. Mm. Still, young people getting stuck in and doing it, though. You know, and. I suppose it would be very hard for a silly old codger to go down and try not to be too know-all and whatnot.
Yeah.
So it's a different world. But, no, I would love it. I think it was the most... The thing that awestruck me, particularly having gone into a business life afterwards, was that... if your radio broke down when you're on FIDS, there was nothing you could do about it except get the manual out and fix it. If your camera packed in, you got your wee screwdriver and you set about taking it to bits to see how it worked. If it didn't, if you couldn't fix it, it was done. So you're entirely involved in what you did, how you achieved things under your own steam. And I think that really helped me in my business career, because I was never really afraid of having a go at things, and we went about it in a different way to other people. So in our shops, you know, I was basically a shopkeeper over the years, but we made all our own shop fittings, and we did all the shop fittings out ourselves, and saved tens of thousands of pounds, well, hundreds of thousands of pounds over the years in doing that. So it finished up as quite a large business, and it was unique and very FID-like in its operation.
So. It's been great fun. Thank you, Spike.
Okay.